All right, so today I'm going to try and wrestle back necessity from the evil powers people who have tried to take it away. There's a sort of a good historical basis of thinking that when powers are exercised, their effects come about as a matter of necessity. And I think that was just always taken as the sort of standard and assumed, and I don't think anybody thought about it very hard until recently. And when people started thinking about it, and particularly you get Marcus Schrenk, I think in 2010, and Ronnie Anjum and Stephen Mumford in their 2011 book, have thought about it and decided that necessity needs to go. So even though they're friends of powers, they are enemies of necessitarianism. And instead, they want us to make use of a notion that they call tending, or sometimes just a kind of raw dispositionalism. And to be fair, I have a hard time making sense of it. It may be that that's the only answer, but at least prima facie, I want nothing to do with tending. And at this point, unless I'm forced to go into tending, I'm not going to go there willingly. So things tend to do such and such. And that's supposed to be a help. So necessity bad, tending good. My feeling is I have no idea what tending is, so let's see if we can rescue necessity. Or at least let's see what, you know, whether we're forced into this tending or not. And I think that we can rescue necessity. I don't think I can rescue it for everybody, and it's certainly not my aim to do so. So if people have different accounts of powers, they're going to have different problems sort of vis-a-vis some of these worries. But I think that there's a sort of group of accounts, and certainly my account, that can do much better by necessity than the kinds of arguments they come up with. So that's the basic aim for today, and then the sort of, you've got the handout, and it takes us through the five sections that I've kind of churned this up into, starting with their arguments, and then a kind of part response in terms of clarifying what really constitutes a counterexample to necessity for the kinds of things we're looking at, by considering what actually is the exercising of powers. And then a kind of a response that might be made, which is appearing in some of the sort of brand new literature regarding a kind of rethinking of stimuli. And so I look at that, work through it. Ultimately, I reject it. But in its rejection, I think you can start to see where I would see you can build up a model where necessity can work. And so I give that in section 4. And then in 5, I have sort of put aside one worry, and I come back to think about that and try on some responses, which I am not altogether happy with, but I am growing in my happiness because I can't find anything better. So sometimes you just start, it's like, there is a wart, and you learn to love the wart of your view and realize that the intuitions that would take you away from the warts are not as good as you thought. So even though we've got sort of two published works, I'm going to sort of treat their arguments as one. If they differ, I will tend towards that of Mumford and Anjum, because they've got more going on. But pretty much, I think their argument, Schrenk's arguments, are much the same. So I'll just talk about their arguments without differentiating the two. As a sort of caveat, they have a tendency to all speak about manifestation types, which I'm going to stay away from, as I take it that power theorists and certainly myself are causal singularists. So what we really care about is causation in the single case. And whether or not types bear on that, or whether examples about types bear on that, is not at all clear. So if they can create a problem for singular cases, then there's a real problem. But type problems are less problematic. Okay, so what's the argument? We're asked to consider some power P, whose nature it is to produce an effect E in circumstances C. Schrenk provides the example of a uranium pile disposed to chain react catastrophically when it reaches critical mass. Mumford and Anjum opt for a match that is disposed to light when struck. So if it's the case they claim that powers produce their manifestations when triggered as a matter of necessity, then we should be ensured of the outcome every time the power finds itself in circumstances C. But both claim that our intuitions tell us that this isn't the case. So you can prevent, they say, any power from producing its manifestation if some sort of antidote is administered. So the chain reaction can be prevented if we insert boron rods into the uranium pile. They absorb the radiation. The chain reaction is prevented. And the match Mumford and Anjum like to talk about would fail to light if a gust of wind picks up at the right moment. So both arguments envisage scenarios involving a process that leads from the stimulation to the manifestation. It follows that there's some non-zero temporal duration to the process as a whole. It runs from TO to T1. And it's this temporal extent that permits the possibility of interference, an antidote in this case, or what have you. So in a sense, they are exploiting the same sort of machinery that Byrd, way back now in 1998, objected to Lewis's revised counterfactual analysis. They're using the same devices to undermine necessity. And according to both, what drives the counterexamples is that necessity is monotonic. That's to say that if the connection between a stimulated power and its manifestation is metaphysically necessary, then it has to be the case that the manifestation will obtain regardless of what is added to P. So if P necessarily leads to E in C, then just as long as P is in C, E must come about. No matter what we add, even if we follow C by immediately administering the antidote. So they go on to use monotonicity. In fact, Mumford and Antrim use monotonicity specifically to generate what they call the antecedent strengthening test, which you have in your handout. So that whenever A necessitates B, we get a true conditional of the form if A and phi, then B, regardless of what value phi takes. So then they use this to sort of plop in obvious interferers and such in the phi location, and intuition shows us that, hey, we don't seem to get the effects we wanted. Neither present the case this way, but I like to think of it as a kind of what I call a toy world counterfactual intuition pump. So when we think about these cases, we sort of take a little event in the world, and we pluck it out of the world, and then we drop it in other worlds, and then we start the world up again, and we see what happens. And the thought is, as they're saying, that if you pluck that thing out of the world and drop it in a world with an interferer, you don't get the effect you want, therefore we don't have necessity. And that's sort of what's at work. And you'll see me, maybe not so many words, but sort of metaphorically plucking out bits of the world and dropping them, thinking about what's going on there when I sort of consider this. So that's the argument. As Mumford and Antrim say, it is based on the assumption that any causal process can be interfered with or prevented by the introduction of some additional factor. And is such that, even if it didn't, it could have done. A may have caused B, but might not have done so if it had been interfered with or prevented. So on that basis, they are opposed to necessity. On to section two. Most of the examples that they make use of involve what I'm going to call late preventers. It's kind of borrowing the way Lewis thinks about this when he talks about counterfactual stuff. A late preventer is something that acts after the stimulation occurs, stopping or diverting the process, and thereby preventing the manifestation. So the boron rods are late preventers in their prevention of the catastrophe. It exploits the time a power's process takes after stimulation to go through to the completion of the manifestation. By contrast, an early preventer would be something that blocks the process at the outset, like if you stirred a neutralizer into the poison wine before it gets drunk, or simply refuse to drink the poison wine because you anticipate that you're going to be subject to a murder by poison. Unlike late preventers, however, cases of early prevention can't be used as counterexamples to the necessity thesis. It would not be a putative counterexample if an early preventer were to prevent the triggering event from ever taking place. That's because, if you recall, the proposed necessity holds between a stimulated power and its manifestation. So the only successful examples are those in which the power is stimulated, but the manifestation doesn't come about. No one in the debate, on any side, denies that powers can go unmanifested. So whether a power is stimulated or not, that is a contingent matter. Or at least it's contingent for the sake of this debate. You might have grander pictures about whether anything's contingent, but for purposes here. So what's at issue is whether they must necessarily produce their manifestations when stimulated. Oddly, I think both Schrenk and Mumford and Antrim at times overlook this. They speak often, especially Mumford and Antrim, about matches being wet as a problematic case for necessity. But wet matches are not ones that are appropriately stimulated. They're not in the right circumstances for their manifestation. So maskers like this aren't a challenge to necessity. It is only stimulated powers, and a wet match is a stimulated power. So this point is sort of important enough to warrant repetition. Not only must there be some power P that is disposed to do E and C, C must occur, and it must occur in such a way as to have P as one of its constituents. It's not enough that P merely obtain and C occurs. To count as a stimulation, C must involve P in the appropriate way. And we'll get to what that is shortly. Put simply, in terms of cause and effect, genuine counterexamples are those in which we have a cause but no effect. If we have no cause and no effect, we have no counterexample. In order to get clear about this, it's going to be useful to take a look at, briefly, a sort of portion of what causation looks like on the powers-based account. So given the standard account, at least that I'm fond of, what constitutes a stimulation is nothing more than the presence or absence of other powers. The salt exercises its power to go in solution when met with a solvent that has the reciprocal power of dissolving the salt. So the two powers, the solubility and the power to dissolve, are what Charlie Martin famously calls reciprocal powers. These powers work together cooperatively to produce what is their, as he calls it, mutual manifestation. So Martin refers to power pairs as partners, and it's their partnering that leads this way. But we shouldn't be misled into thinking that powers are only operative in pairs. Martin often speaks this way, and I think it's misleading. Some powers require no partners at all, and we'll get to some of those later, briefly. But the vast majority act in great big bundles, which I like to call constellations. So a constellation is nothing more than a collection of powers in some arrangement or other. And that arrangement, obtaining, is what gives rise to some manifestation, jointly brought about by the powers in the constellation. But they're not just collections of powers, they are collections of powers appropriately arranged. So that's why I steal the notion of constellations, because now are arrangements more important than in sort of astrological constellations. From here, anyway, stars look pretty much the same. And so arrangements is all you have. I'm sure if you could get closer or if you were better at that sort of science, you could differentiate constellations with more depth and stuff and distance. But for us, they're pretty much certain shape of, starlights. And there it's an essential feature. It's likewise an essential feature when it comes to the arrangements of powers in these constellations. And it would be a serious mistake to overlook the different manifestations that can arise from the very same set of powers differently arranged. To wit, the lighting of a match requires more than just having a match along with a striking surface and some oxygen. That combination can produce many manifestations. It requires that the oxygen enfold the match as it's rubbed along the surface and the red phosphorus is heated by the friction. Another key feature of constellations, and it'll probably prove most important as we move on, is not just what they include, but what they exclude. So, in addition to their arrangements, if you add or subtract powers to or from a constellation, it results in a distinct constellation. And therefore, you have the potential for a distinct manifestation. Effectively, the identity of constellation is given by the set of powers and their arrangement therein. If you change any of those by changing their arrangement, adding something into the negative space, what have you, you get the potential for a different manifestation. I say potential because it might be that lots of different arrangements of powers result in the same outcome. Famously, people have said that there are many ways to skin a cat. Probably true, in which case you get a skinned cat. Lots of different constellations, same outcome. But what's important is that you have no guarantee that if you change the constellation, you will have the same output. So the potential is there, and that's enough. So the negative space is just as important to the constellation as the positive space. And I think that gets overlooked, and that will be key as we move on. All right, so returning to the arguments against necessity and what would constitute a genuine counterexample, it ought to be clear that some of the putative counterexamples that Schrenk and Mumford and Anjum employ are not counterexamples at all. In fact, the striking of the match in otherwise optimal lighting conditions, but with the addition of some factor like a gust of wind, which is supposed to undermine our necessity claim, isn't something that's fair. Striking a match in a gust of wind isn't the same thing as striking a match without a gust present. So a gust of wind is really, some high-speed movement of particles through the air or something. It's probably a really, really, really complicated constellation, but we will cheat and simplify it by treating a gust as if it were an object, because we can do that. And you can see, you take a constellation, which is the arrangement of powers involved in a lighting, there is no gust present. If you add a gust, you have a new constellation. Therefore, you have no guarantee that you would have the same outcome as you would previously. Hence, it's not fair when you assess whether a constellation is going to give rise to some effect or other that you would assess some other constellation altogether. In fact, here's my cheeky kicker. If asked what happens when you try to light a match in a gust of wind, people will tell you that it won't light. Strange. It seems that they know what the outcome of that is, as if that was necessitated, as if a gusty constellation is for a non-lighting. Because people know that, because it seems to track necessity. Anyway, but that's slightly cheeky. So we get a change in the constellation when we add a gust of wind. So examples like this are not fair examples, because they don't constitute the same scenario. They are distinct scenarios. It's not simply a matter that the powers be there. The powers and the negative space in the constellation need to be involved. The same goes for any putative counterexample with the same structure. If the case involves manipulating the set or arrangement of powers interacting with the power in question, then it's a different constellation, and therefore not a potential counterexample. You can see this at work more generally with the antecedent strengthening test of necessity. Mumford and Anjum assert that we can fill in any value for phi, but once the way in which powers are exercised is properly understood, we see that numerous values for phi constitute a replacement of A, so can't be added. The test, therefore, is often misleading, or, strictly speaking, often misapplied, as I think they plug in the wrong thing for A. I won't go into it here because I don't have space, but as a brief kind of worry as well when it comes to counterexamples, both Schrenk and Mumford and Anjum tend to, without argument and without discussion and without any mention of it whatsoever, treat events as abstract, coarse-grained, and non-fragile. If you don't know what any of those mean, it would take me a while to describe, but sort of briefly, it means that the way they are thinking about event identity is highly repeatable, highly translatable across possible worlds, and highly non-specific. But there's no reason why that should be our account of events at all. In fact, so if we take a case like if the striking of the match named a concrete event, so a sort of Quinean account that takes it to be some space of the world, it would have no room left to be a striking plus a gust of wind. That would be a distinct event. The same sort of problems come with sort of fragility if you make it much more specific. So if it was not simply the striking of a match, but the striking of match X on a Chilean mountain in the middle of June at 4 p.m., the ability to repeat that event and have it be the same event is much harder. They opt for a much more non-specific approach to events and gain a lot of traction out of that. And it's sort of unargued for, and I don't think it's the right way to treat events, period. I don't really have space to do it, so I'll say that much. Okay. So for B, a genuine counterexample, we need a power that meets with the appropriate constellation, but nevertheless fails to bring about the manifestation which that constellation is for. So the only things we need to worry about are late preventers. So how can we deal with them? All right. One of the first ways is this strategy, which I said is sort of kicking around. So if you're a fan of the conditional analysis, you might be excused for thinking that traditional talk of cause and effect could just be translated into stimulus and manifestation. And I would give you that, but you would be wrong. And that's fine. So according to the simple analysis, something X is disposed of time T to give response R to stimulus S. If and only if X were to undergo stimulus S at time T, X would give response R. That it fails is old hat. That revised versions also fail is also old hat. But the sort of new worries about the account that are starting to arise, and they're coming out of a shift in the thinking about what it is to be a stimulus source or for stimuli. And in fact, stimuli in some circles is becoming a thing of the past too. So part of that move comes from recognition that some powers have nothing at all that counts as a stimulus. They are stimulus-free. So the decay of radium atoms, for instance, is entirely insensitive to external conditions. For powers like this, there's nothing that counts as their possible stimulus. They are entirely insensitive to the change of the world around them. Likewise, for those that are permanently manifesting, so things like gravitational force or gravitational attraction of massive bodies, it's constantly manifested under all conditions. It doesn't respond to some state of the world and then act. It just acts. Powers like this can't be interfered with in the way the argument requires, because there's no process from stimulation to manifestation. And if you can't muck with the process, you can't provide cases where the power ought to have been manifested but failed to do so. So you can stop the argument to necessity. They are impervious in this sense. But you might think, and plenty of people have thought, that perhaps these things aren't powers at all. So Brian Ellis has this view. He says these things aren't powers because they lack interaction. I think that's false, but I can understand where it's coming from. And even if you're not in his camp and you're in my camp, you're going to recognize that the sort of class of stimulus-free powers is going to be pretty darn small. So you might have a tiny little set of powers that are insulated from the argument against necessity, but it's not enough. All right. So that's sort of the first shift in stimulus, is that some things don't happen. The second shift is actually much more systematic and much more interesting in some ways. And if it was adopted, it would insulate all powers whatsoever from the argument. The second sort of approach is not an elimination of stimulation per se, but such a change that it might as well be. So the move starts by rejecting the assumption that powers-based causation can be captured within the traditional model at all of causation, wherein causes are clearly distinguished from their effects and always obtained prior to them. This has resulted in some cases talk of the so-called stimulus as being identical with the manifestation. Others, it's treating them as overlapping and sometimes indistinguishable. So the sort of first theoretical move in this shift comes from E.J. Lowe, who's recently argued that the conditional analysis is doomed because it relies on this mistaken conception. According to Lowe, the understanding of powers that you need in order to be able to reduce them this way treats stimulations and manifestations as distinct, but here's a quote that I think, oh, you don't have this one, it's the second one. In reality, what is called the stimulus is not aptly so named at all, since it can't stand in the causal relation to the manifestation, being in truth only a logically necessary condition of the latter. So Lowe considers the case of water solubility of salt and its stimulus, so-called, of immersion in water. Placing the salt in water, he argues, is not some event that causally triggers the salt's solubility. Rather, it's a necessary condition of its going into solution. Putting the salt in water doesn't cause the manifestation. It's simply necessary for the manifestation to come about. What else, he says, would you expect, given that immersion in water is built into the very notion of water solubility? So this one you do have on the handout. It is a misconception, I'm going to read quotes to you like you can't read. It is a misconception to suppose that being in water is some condition which functions, or even could function, as a cause of the manifestation of water solubility whenever that disposition is manifested, together, perhaps with other causes. And yet it seems clear this is precisely what being in water is understood to be by those who regard it as the stimulus of that disposition. So the manifestation of water solubility, says Lowe, is that of being dissolved by water. It's not in a prior event of immersing the salt in the water that is required for the salt to go in solution, but its continued immersion in non-saturated water. Hence, there's no stimulus per se, at least not in the sense of a causally efficacious event that is prior to the manifestation. It might be conceptually prior that certain conditions obtain in order for the manifestation, but that's not nearly the same. Charlie Martin gives us the kind of second element in this latter shift. According to Martin, the manifestation of a power is just a matter of its being in those circumstances in which the power is enacted. So you have this quote as well. You should not think of disposition partners jointly causing the manifestation. Instead, the coming together of the disposition partners is the mutual manifestation. The partnering and the manifestation are identical. The partnering is the manifestation. So it's not one in which the picture of stimulation's gone away completely. They still require something to be active, the presence and absence of other powers. But the circumstances are not distinct from the manifestations coming about. What's gone away is the temporal sequence that the anti-essentialist exploits in producing counterexamples. What's surprising, in fact, given the direction they go, is that we find similar sentiments in Mumford and Anjum's account of power-based causation, in their positive account. So whereas Martin's wont to speak of identity, Mumford and Anjum put this in terms of simultaneity. Causes, they claim, are simultaneous with their effects. Effects begin as soon as the powers are appropriately ranged, but those causes continue alongside the effects until the terminus is reached. And that's where you can see the potential significance of this approach to our discussion. The only event you could describe as the stimulus, namely the immersions of the salt in water, is coincident with the manifestation of its being dissolved, if not identical. So the two are either co-located events or the same event differently described. Either way, there's no space in which to insert an interferer. Moreover, owing to the coincidence or even identity, they are necessarily connected, so to speak, in the sense that one could not have occurred without the other. Certain forms of intervention might prevent the salt being placed in the water, but these are cases in which the stimulation, as it's so-called, is prevented. So outside the class of possible counterexamples. When the salt is immersed in the water, we get the stimulation and the manifestation together, blocking the argument against necessity. Again, a full investigation of these views, which I think are sort of interesting, new, and different ways in which people are taking the literature, would take us too far afield. But I think there's enough of a flavor there to sense that if those views worked, you would have something entirely unlike what the anti-necessitarians are attacking, even if it's the same people doing it. So now what we need to ask ourselves, and this is where the handout turns, is whether these shifts can in fact insulate powers from necessity. Because I think the promise here might be too much. And this is why I don't go into greater detail into these accounts, because I reject both of them. So chief among the phenomena theories of causation are built to explain are changes in the properties instantiated by objects. I take that as a basic datum. It would therefore be shocking if an account of causation were to be such that it ruled out the possibility of change. And I don't mean this in a kind of one of these four-dimensional McTaggart kind of ways. I mean, there is no model under which there's change here. But if stimulations are identical with their manifestations, then this follows. The very powers that jointly give rise to the manifestations must themselves be the manifestation. So change is impossible. No powers can be lost or gained as a result of those self-same powers interacting. So it follows the identity model I stated is just highly, just untenable. Does simultaneity fare any better? Not if we take it at face value. So on a literal reading of simultaneity, the stimulation and the manifestation perfectly overlap in time. That, I take it, is what simultaneous means. They need not include exactly the same set of properties, but if the manifestation of some object X's power P were to have as its manifestation the loss of P, then there's simply no way that the stimulation can be simultaneous with the manifestation. Simultaneity, thus understood, is not worth taking seriously. If we're to take this model as viable at all, we're going to have to treat simultaneity as slightly metaphorical. It'll need to be what we might call, or what I will call, wide scope simultaneity. That is, the simultaneity will be for parts of the stimulation with parts of the manifestation when we consider the entire process over its full extent. For instance, Mumford and Anjum discuss immersing a sugar cube in liquid. This is a necessary precondition, but the whole cube does not dissolve instantly. A very small portion, perhaps just the outermost molecules, will dissolve instantly or near enough. Hence, right at that first moment of immersion, we have part of the manifestation, the part that is the exterior part having gone into solution. Some portion of sugar has gone into solution, but there is still plenty of undissolved sugar, so the so-called stimulation here continues, along with further molecules going into solution simultaneously. So we've got layers and layers of sugar cube, that's probably slightly molecularly incorrect, but ignore that, going into solution at the same time as parts of it is already in solution. This is how they take it to be a kind of overlapping, and I think this is the most charitable and sensible reading of their notion of simultaneity. Thus, in this way, we can treat the stimulation of the relevant powers as taking place at effectively the same time as the manifestation. But we only get it if we treat the manifestation here as the entire sugar cubes being dissolved, not this or that part of it. This is the wide scope at work, allowing us to have stimulation and manifestation at the same time. If we zoom in on the process, the simultaneity is lost. The dissolution of the outermost molecules falls immediately or very quickly after their immersion. At no time are the very same molecules both dissolved and not dissolved. That I want to maintain to the end of the earth. It is a series of brief, non-simultaneous steps like this. Molecules now in contact with the solvent, then quickly dissolve, that gives the overall process, which we treat as wide-scope simultaneous. So we understand simultaneity in this way. It gives a viable picture of powers-based causation, but it comes at a price. It's that this wide-scope total manifestation is something that can be prevented. All right. So wide-scope sort of manifestation is something that builds up through the process. More and more of the molecules that comprise the cube go into solution until all of the cube is dissolved. At any step along the way, we could remove the cube or add some other chemical to the water or enact some antidote and block the process before it runs to sort of full cube dissolution. We would still have had the appropriate constellation of powers required for the manifestation, but we would only have had part of the manifestation, not the full wide scope manifestation we were after. It follows that simultaneity in any guise is not going to rid us of the anti-necessitarian. But we now have our disposal, I will claim, the tools to get the job done. And that's where we shift into part four. Okay, so Mumford and Nanjum claim that the causes and effects of power-based causation are simultaneous. We've seen that this only makes sense if we understand simultaneity as wide scope. And if our only way of thinking about the sugar cube was in terms of all the sugar having dissolved, or none of the sugar having dissolved, then you could do a lot worse than seeing the effect as simultaneous with its cause. But we're not stuck interpreting the case as all or nothing, and we have better options available to us as a result. To wit, once we recognize the process as a product of a series of powers working together, we can correctly see the dissolving as a series of constellations and manifestations, no pair of which is simultaneous. If we focus just on the smallest part of the sugar cube's exterior, then when it's gone into the solution, we can say of the whole cube that it is partly dissolved. And that might again tempt us to say that the two are simultaneous. But the correct description is when we get closer, that one part has dissolved. It's done. And it required a certain constellation of powers in order to bring that about. That portion's going into solution was not simultaneous with its cause. It was immediate, it was quick, it was perhaps even instantaneous, but it was not simultaneous. Once we drop our sort of clumsy wide brush and pick up a finer instrument, we get away from simultaneity and closer to necessity. The contrast comes from what we treat as a manifestation when looking at a process with a wide scope versus the fine-grained manifestations for which the constellations are legitimately four. So it's because we think of manifestations as arising in full only at the end of a process that we can envisage something that acts during that process to prevent it from running completion. For any process, you can look at it in a more fine-grained sort of way and see it involves steps. Because it involves steps, we can make sense of an interferer that would change the direction of the process or stop it entirely, such that the terminus of the process is not reached. But now let's think about the steps more carefully. If the process is such that it can be interfered with, then it has to be the case that it's interruptible. If it couldn't be interrupted no matter what, then nothing could interfere with it, and there would be no argument here against necessity. Are there powers that have uninterruptible processes like this? Maybe. Ultimately, I think so, but I think probably micro-entities have powers like this. In which case it would be hard to argue against interference for them. But let's assume, for the sake of argument, that most powers aren't like this. Powers we typically ascribe to the mid-size objects, at least, don't appear to be. So consider then just those powers whose manifestations are interruptible, in the sense just considered. How can they be interrupted? The answer is that they are composed of a series of smaller steps, and those can be made to do something other than lead to the terminus. But this only makes sense if the preventer or interferer is operating causally on the powers and objects involved. The very notion of interruptibility is itself a dispositional notion. It speaks to the fact that we have a causal structure here. In other words, the process here is a series of much shorter states which are causally connected with one another, like a line of dominoes. Now, recall that as friends of powers, we were thinking of causation as boiling down to the exercising of powers. If these steps in the process are causally connected, as it would have to be for them to be interruptible, then what we have is not a single constellation whose manifestation is a process, but very many constellations one after the next, whose manifestations are the brief states that make up the larger process we initially had in mind. Unlike that larger process, each of the shorter manifestations is not interruptible, so can avoid the anti-necessitarian words. Moreover, if they are interruptible, it's again because they're composed of yet smaller steps of causally connected stage, these constellation-manifestation pairs. And we can continue to break those down until we get uninterruptible manifestations. Hence, once we get down to the level of genuine manifestations, not the wide scope thing we were looking at sort of clumsily, then they can no longer be mucked with, which is to say that they are necessary. All right, so thinking of powers this way allows us to avoid the objection of necessity. But what do we now say about the typical powers we ascribe to mid-size objects that we're so common we like to do? The answer is that these powers will not be real powers at all. They will be powers in name only, rough and ready accounts of how things tend to occur in the world. After all, we recognize powers of this sort because we see processes of a certain kind unfold. But these need not always run to fruition, as we've seen. They're composed of many iterations of constellation manifestation pairs. And the reason we find the longer process to be largely reliable models of the world is because, for the most part, if you line things up in the right way and start it up, you will tend to get some later, much later state of the world that you anticipate. Think about domino toppling. If you set up all the dominoes some way, you have a pretty good sense of what you expect to be the outcome. That's true. That process, though, is something you can muck at every stage, but the individual steps you can't muck with. So you can't prevent a given constellation from manifesting, but you can add things later and change the constellations and thereby change what comes about. So what I'm here suggesting is that powers don't have manifestation states that arise at the end of a lengthy process, but very brief states of affairs that are near enough immediate. These might turn out to be very, very brief indeed. The powers we most often tend to ascribe and that we look out for in our navigation of the world are what I like to think of as process initiators. They are effectively stacking up the dominoes somewhere. They terminate in some long-term manifestation that we anticipate, but the real power is for the first link and nothing more. So we like to pick out such chains. We can predict with reasonable success when the first link in the chain occurs that we will tend to get the last, but the connection there is not that of necessity. That is reserved for the real relations that hold between the single links. Okay, on to the final section. Once we come to see our power descriptions, the familiar ones like solubility and flammability, as handy but inexact gestures of the real powers, we are well on our way to avoiding the sort of concerns that have been raised against necessity. And then when we come to see the relevant processes as supervening on sequences of fast-acting constellation manifestation pairs, necessity for manifestations is restored. All is well and good. But one worry remains. So in responding to the anti-necessitarian, I relied on an important fact of powers-based causation. It's that non-identical constellation of powers have, at least potentially, non-identical manifestations. So in many cases, similar constellations will have similar manifestations, but no promise is made that if the constellation differs even slightly, that the outcome will be the same. This is significant as it allows the necessitarian... This is significant in the argument I've presented as it allows the necessitarian to argue that cases of putative early preventers are not potential counterexamples because they are cases in which the relevant constellation doesn't obtain. But what if a constellation were to abstain... obtain in toto, so in whole, a whole thing, and properly arranged as a proper part of an even larger constellation? Given that these larger constellations constitute additions to the powers, the assumption's been made that this was a new constellation. And so it is what determines the manifestation that's produced. But just how big are constellations then? Are we going to end up with the state of the entire universe? The worry here is that we've rescued necessity at the cost of locality. So consider our Superman case again. Superman tries to lift a large rock. That's easy for him, and he lifts the rock. Now take every part of that constellation in the identical arrangement and place it in a bigger space. Now add to that bigger space, so we've got Superman, his rock here, bigger space. We add a chunk of kryptonite. We now have a new constellation, and we know that the manifestation here is a non-lifting of the rock. Both, as presented, ought to produce their manifestation necessarily, but given that the first is embedded in the second, we can only maintain the necessity if we also adopt a principle to the effect that larger constellations trump smaller constellations. And that seems perfectly reasonable. If we add extra stars around Scorpio, what results is not Scorpio plus some larger constellation, but a new constellation. So far, so good. Bigger constellations trump smaller ones. Necessity is maintained. But now you might start to wonder just how big these things have to be. Imagine that we've got Superman again, and we've got this piece of kryptonite that is 8 meters to his left. And now imagine that there is some other stuff, which, I don't know, maybe exists in Superman world, I have no idea, which is anti-kryptonite. And it is 8 meters to the left of the kryptonite. We now have a larger constellation for which the manifestation is a lifting. And it seems like you could iterate this infinitely. The bigger you get, the more you include. What's worse is that if you look at this constellation, it has a space over here if we take out the anti-kryptonite. But there could have been anti-kryptonite there. So it has to include that space. Now we worry that in order to recognize the lack of kryptonite, it doesn't have to add anything, but it does have to be big enough to include that negative space. So the inclusion of the appropriate amount of negative space seems to get really, really big indeed. These sort of zones that we get seem to get bigger and bigger and bigger. So when considering possible objections, Schrenk and Mumford & Nanjing both anticipate and reject something like the process of increasing the size of the stimulus, the constellation, as I call it, which they call the sigma strategy. And the general idea is that one might be able to get around the problems the possibility of prevention produces by adding more and more to the stimulus constellation. And this, as they say, includes very remote factors we typically ignore, and even negative factors like the absence of this or that potential interferer. I have put them in those terms, but it boils down to much the same thing. We pack this into the super sigma structure. We ask if that were necessitated. They claim it wouldn't, and they have four objections that you have on your handout. They are that one cannot legitimately appeal to negative factors as causes. Two, constellations like sigma would rarely, if ever, recur. Three, even if sigma is very large, something outside it might still serve as a preventer. And four, further insulating sigma can only be done artificially, so they think it's question big. We've already seen that the first objection is a non-starter. The negative space of constellations is as much a part of the constellation as the positive parts. They're not causes. Only the powers produce anything. But the negative space is key to constellation identity. There's this line that David Lewis has, I think it's in a footnote, in Void and Object, where he's talking about Martin's view. And he says, Martin says something like, spaces are causally relevant, but not causally operative. And he says, I have no idea what that means. If you follow my account, you know exactly what it means. Spaces are causally relevant because they help define constellation identity. They're not doers. The only doers are powers. So they are, the absences are causally relevant, but they are not causally operative. Maybe that's what Martin wanted out of it half the time. Interpreting Martin's like, it's like a bit like reading Wittgenstein. So you see what you want to see, you add it, turn around. The second objection is similarly toothless. That identical constellations are unlikely to recur isn't entirely desirable epistemically, but it's no threat to necessity. And even if epistemically, it's not that troubling, I don't think, because we can still allow that similar enough manifestations come from similar enough constellations. The fact that we've built in that a difference in constellation doesn't guarantee a difference in manifestation doesn't mean that it can still be the same, and it doesn't mean that lots of very similar cases can produce lots of very similar ones. So that leaves us really worried with the third and fourth objections. But you can meet the third, like I said, by making the constellation all-inclusive. But doing so runs afoul of our intuition that causation is a largely local affair. You can push back by trying to restrict the size of constellations, but now the threat of artificiality is looming. Question is their balance. Let's call the region that determines a constellation its neighborhood. Effectively, that says how big the space is that it's operating in. The task then is to determine just how big neighborhoods must be, or if you prefer, just how small we can get them, without compromising necessity. First off, in fact, mostly all off, I want to note that our intuitions regarding the locality of causes, this is where I said I'm going to start to get fishy and I'm not totally happy with my answer. So our intuitions regarding locality are not nearly as restrictive as we often take them to be. So on the one hand, we typically take things to be local. So if I'm typing at a computer, we think that the causal scenario there is one that involves like me and the computer. But now consider that same event with like some giant electromagnet not that far outside. And everyone's quite happy to recognize what that's going to do to my computer and the event. So it looked like that event was always that big because it was going to include the sorts of things that were big enough. Constellation was big. It's not sort of intolerably non-local there. But it shows already that our intuitions regarding causal spheres of influence are not microscopic. Secondly, though I like to employ examples that use things like kryptonite, this is intended to be an account of causation for the properties of our world. We think of neighborhoods as quite restricted because that's how they look to us. So why not assume, in keeping with this, that it's the nature of power properties, simply it's not their nature to act over large distances. This is an account of natural properties. If the natural properties have specific spheres of influence, then the spheres and the spaces between them are what determine neighborhoods. This sounds slightly ad hoc. We ought to be guided by the world in these cases. So being guided by the world might give us locality, but then again it might not. And that's something we should be fine with. If quantum entanglement turns out to be as described, then perhaps we're just wrong to ever thought that causation was a local matter. And we're happy to allow that massive bodies exert influence over huge distances. And it might turn out that there are such spooky things as gravitons that are acting as intermediaries, and then they might not. Maybe there's nothing like that. Would it be so strange to learn that powers at vast distances were in fact part of what we took to be quite local interactions, especially if the distant powers made only infinitesimally small differences to the sort of manifestations that result? We tend to think of tiny pockets of the world as causally isolated from the rest, but nevertheless allow that the right sort of power, however distant, could still influence outcomes of that pocket. If we think of neighborhoods as being vast, but treat most powers in them as rarely resulting in distinct or much distinct manifestations, we could harmlessly capture that intuition. As I say, perhaps our localized thinking has been mistaken all along. We screen off parts of the world and test them in the laboratory, conducting experiments that are slightly artificial in this regard. But I've now come to see the artificial as the norm. We take our screening off to be real screening off on the world, and we interpret these tiny portions of the world as primary, making larger portions artificial. And now we might be right, but we might just as well be mistaken. The fact is, our intuitions about locality are pretty meager and could easily be mistaken. Right or wrong, we can get neighborhoods of interacting powers that would fit the bill, however big the bill is, and preserve necessity. And if it should turn out that our sense of locality is off the mark and neighborhoods are truly expansive, then as long as distant powers make little difference to local affairs, we could still make use of local-like interactions through talk of, you know, quasi-neighborhoods and quasi-constellations. Strictly, we're cheating, because those aren't the real acting things, but they would be really handy for doing such things as, I don't know, science. So just as genuine processes that we tend to track will supervene on the genuine powers, which are much more instantaneous, we tend to track the ones that are largely stable and traceable. Distant powers might be included, but if they tend not to be difference makers with respect to the manifestations, ignoring them would be harmless. So in sum, our intuitions about locality may not be the best guide to the real size of powerful neighborhoods. But either way, they're going to be determined by the true nature of powers. So the worry about locality is not nearly as troubling as it might seem. All right, in conclusion, here's my sermon. When doing philosophy, one needs to be wary of cases where sticking too close to the way we speak is as much a hindrance as it is a help. Nowhere is this more apparent than in debates over the nature of causation. It is thus always worth keeping in mind, especially as we consider questions of powers and necessity. The extent to which we are appealing to intuitions regarding our causal talk and the layman's approach to causes, instead of a more refined account of powers. This might well be one of those cases where our everyday causal talk and the facts about causation come apart. Powers might be the truth makers for our causal talk, if or when that talk is true, and if or when it is suitably precise. And I support the view that it is, but we should still be wary of how far off the nature of causation our talk might be. Furthermore, causal literature all too often fails to disambiguate our efforts to analyze our concept of causation from our getting clearer about what the genuine nature of causal processing is. The two have clear points of intersection, but are not the same. I worry that at times Schrenk and Mumford and Anjum permit too much of the one debate to bleed into the other, and that this has led them away from necessity. Hopefully I've done enough to steer us back.
Thank you very much.